Blog Talk Radio.
When life seems to crush your dreams, so find your balance for all your needs. A little work, some family fun. Find your love, keep your life on the run. Told you how the story goes. So write your own script before you grow old. Live your life, laugh out loud. Own who you are, stand up proud. You gotta find what works for you. Find a balance that lets you be you.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast, episode number 287. And this is Stephen Zimmer coming to you live at Lexington, Kentucky. And joining me tonight from two other locations are the one and only Daniel Dark from Parts Unknown in Tennessee, and also fellow Kentuckian and author extraordinaire R.G. Westerman. So welcome. Good to catch up with you all midweek here.
Hello, hello.
Yes, it is.
I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. It's good to hear you all. I've been at the grindstone on the editing and layout and fronts, and yeah, we got some good news on that regard here just in a minute or two. But how have you two been doing? And RG, yeah, this is the first time I've gotten to talk to you in a couple of weeks at least. So give us some updates.
Oh gosh, I've got all kinds of stuff going on. The audiobook for Rising Ash is officially in production. There are sound bites recorded, and I am super excited.
Cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah. And I was going to do it myself, but I don't have a sound studio. So I ended up hiring it out and found an incredibly talented voice actress who is doing it through ACX. So I'm really, really excited to see the final product on that.
Yeah, those ACX narrators are awesome. I mean, you find a lot of talent there.
Yeah.
It's always an eye-opener.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I listened to a couple of different auditions, and then I listened to hers, and like immediately within the first sentence, I was like, I think I found my narrator. So, yeah. Yeah, but it's really exciting, and I'm in communication with her back and forth. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah, we'll be talking audiobooks with tonight's guest, who is a show favorite, to say the least. So that'll be a lot of fun when we get underway with him tonight. And I'm already laughing because I know what to expect.
All you have to do is say the name, and everyone knows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll keep you all in suspense unless you've bothered to see our show announcements and graphics for the week, in which case you already know who it is. An excellent guest, I might say. I do have some good news for everybody. I want to give a little bit of a sneak peek, a little scoop, because I like to do that with people that listen to the Star Chamber show. But next Halloween weekend, we actually have not one, not two, but three brand new releases coming from the press all at once. It's going to be a Halloween extravaganza. And in this trio of releases are award-winning editor, Bram Stoker, award-winning editor Michael Nost, brand new short story collection called Dark Splinters. And this is a great collection where he did not give them, he was doing an online class with a lot of really good writers, many of them published and some that have not yet been published but are extremely talented. And he challenged them to do a short story and work with them as an editor. And this is the results that he gave some guidelines and did not tell them any particular theme or genre, so he kind of turned them loose there within a set of guidelines, and telling you, it's a fantastic collection, and it also includes Seven Star Press author Lee E.E. Stone has one of the stories in it, and it is absolutely first rate. But most of the stories fit with dark fiction, paranormal, weird mythology, horror, so all of, pretty much all of the stories in it fit perfectly with the Halloween theme. So, and the cover art does too, which we are going to be showing off in the next day or two. And it is, it's going to be a really cool release. And the second one is from Brick Marlin, and that would be Ozarium Edition 2. He had a lot of things that, we actually had a first edition, but he had a lot of things that he wanted to do a little differently with it that he was as creatively really, really wanting to redo. So we agreed to that, and so we have all new cover art and a brand new edition that yours truly actually was editor on, and I think that this edition is, if you read the first one, you're absolutely going to love this one, and if you haven't read the first one, this one, yeah, you're going to love it. I mean, it's dystopian paranormal dystopian horror. It sounds like a mouthful there, but it is really cool. It's got a dystopian kind of setting, a big paranormal element, and it's definitely classic Brick Marlin horror. And then last but not least, I have my third volume of my Hellscapes collection also coming out. Very Clive Barker-esque, very macabre, visceral type horror, very different from all the other stuff I do. But all the stories do have thematic elements, and so there is a purpose to the stories, and it's an exploration of evil in the world and accountability. Key word is accountability, and you probably guessed that with the title like Hellscapes. But, that's coming too. So we actually have three new releases all coming in one weekend. So how's that? What do you think of that, Daniel and Rebecca?
Hellscape is basically about the politics, huh?
Well, Not straight up, but it does explore different types of evil, and you probably can, you could probably glean a little bit of, some of the things that are happening today, but I stray away from the straight political kind of element. It's more fantastical and metaphorical, but it gets more at, just the evil behind things. So certainly, I mean, obviously politics is a lot of that. You can read into the undercurrent, but it gets at a lot of those kind of things. They're very different stories though, very different. And the settings are very different. but it's not for the faint of heart. I mean, they're definitely pretty intense. So if you're not into the Clive Barker-esque kind of horror, it's definitely not something I'd recommend. But if you are, then I'm almost certain that you will love it. And I'm excited to finally have something exciting and new to talk about. So, but and RG, I think you'll get a kick out of it because I know you like horror too. So it'll be fun.
You were describing it, I was sitting back here like, well, if you're into that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think we all are. So.
Yep. It's a big idea kind of concept series, but I've had a lot of fun writing it, and it gives me a chance to play in a genre that I can't go full throttle in the other genres I write. So it does give me a little bit more on the palette as a writer. So I enjoy doing them and certainly plan to continue now. we got three now. So yeah, but I've already got a box of ideas for a fourth. So there's more.
Horror is really fun to write. Like, people who don't write horror, it's a lot of fun to write because it's so, like, cathartic and you get to do in written form things that you don't get to do in real life because it was
right.
Going wrong. So
yeah.
I don't know what that says about me, but.
Yep. And it can be very cathartic, especially when it comes to bad people getting what they deserve. So it's in that sense,
absolutely.
I do think so. But it's going to be fun. And next, I'll be talking about it a little bit next week. But we got a certain someone coming next week that involved with one of those releases. I'll give you a hint. I'll say that he was an editor if you paid attention. So, but yeah, next week we got a big guest coming on next Wednesday to talk about his new release. So it's going to be fun. But I'll probably mention a few things. But let's see here. And okay, I'm just checking the time, and the chat room does look. Yeah, RG's in there too. We got Sandy Lenders, Scott Connolly, Clayton's in there. Hello, Carol Preflatish, and Amy McCorkle. Yeah, we got a lot of folks chatting away, and and waiting for our guests. So I guess I'll go ahead and do the sponsors here, and so that we can dive right into a most excellent evening. But we'll get to that. But tonight's sponsors tonight are Sandy Lender, and tonight back as sponsor again is the wonderful and amazing Renmelian. And Renmelian, if you know her, is I'm talking like Renaissance lady. If you looked up the definition, I mean, it's just a super talented individual who, illustrator, game designer, editor, author, artist. Just about everything. Great, great on video and live streaming, and it's crazy how much. Yeah, she's talented. But yeah, we've got Renmelian and Sandy Lender. So tonight, since we went to Sandy's spot first last week, we'll go with Renmelian, and then we'll give you a spot from Sandy. Here we go from Renmelian.
Have you hit a wall with your story and you're not sure where it's going anymore? Feeling uninspired? Need a book that doesn't look like it's self-published? Hire a muse with 33 years' experience as an illustrator, writer, and designer. Hi, I'm Renmelian. You can find me everywhere online with a quick search, Renmelion. Thanks for tuning into the Star Chamber.
And coming right at you, the one, the only Sandy Lender. And please do get the book being talked about in this spot. You know, show Sandy that you support her for all her great support of the show.
Are you looking for an escape from reality? Follow authors. Tell an artist in your life you support and believe in them. Author Sandy Lender makes that easy with her latest release, 365 Days to Create and Motivate Your Inner Writer. This workbook is a journal, creative resource, and tool of inspiration all rolled up in one, with 365 prompts and suggestions to stoke the creative brain. Grab it from Amazon in time for holiday gift giving. That's 365 Days to Create and Motivate Your Inner Writer by Sandy Lender.
365 Days to Create and Motivate. Yeah, that would definitely cover a full year. So get out there and pick up that book. Pick up that book from Sandy and, show her your appreciation for all she does for the show. So coming over here and right now, we're going to go ahead and bring in our guest. And, yes, it's the excellent one himself. He is an award-winning author of works such as Cosmic Egg Rapture, Serpent Egg Rapture, and then, of course, Contract with the Lycanthrope, always a favorite at events and conventions in the region. And so get ready to have a hoffy good time with the one and the only Rob Hoff. Welcome to the Star Chamber Show. Your mic is on, sir.
All right. Thanks for that introduction. I appreciate it. Yeah, it sounds like Seven Stars got a lot going on with Michael Nost and Brick and, of course, Steve Shrewsbury. I knew he's got a couple things going on. So you've got the Killer of Giants. Is that the one that he's just done?
Yes. Actually, Rob Hoff has given you all a scoop. Now, Stephen has talked about this publicly, but I had not mentioned this yet. But we do have an epic Sword and Sorcery release. Yes, Rob, you're right. Stephen Shrewsbury with a foreword by the one and only Brian Keene. We just got that 2 days ago. Brian Keene gave us a foreword for that. And so you're going to love it, though. It is an awesome. But we have, the artwork being developed for this is amazing. And so right now we're waiting on that. And it's illustrated. Illustrated cover, and I don't want to give anything away because it's eye popping. But that one should be out right before Thanksgiving. So that's gonna be part of the next wave of releases. Yeah, we got Stephen, Carol Prefreitish is coming up in that group, and we got a lot of good releases coming up in the next wave. Yeah.
Well, that is excellent news, there, Stephen.
Yep. So, but you can still get my book next weekend, too.
Oh, yeah. I got one Hellscape. I hear what you're saying.
It's scary.
I was thinking again about Exodus Gate because, you have several things that happen in there in terms of, caricatures of quasi-historic type,
Yes,
so we're all on that same turn the page, and there it is.
Oh, yeah. I just finished book five in that series, and not too long ago, a few weeks ago, and and so that's already in the pipeline and for editing and release.
I know
so
you get on me for not like coming down that way too much, and you do realize you have your OOV over there still at the Switzerland County VB Indiana Art Center. So you
yes,
have plenty.
And I need to get out there.
Yeah, you do need to get out there.
Yeah, I do need to get out there. Yeah, no, I've been very, except for Imaginarium, I have not done anything live in a while, and I really want to buckle down. And well, I'm talking about myself now. I don't want to talk about you, Rob, but just real quickly, I will just say that I want to buckle down and get new volumes and all my major series is done, and I want to make sure that I got all those back on track. So yeah, I did kind of focus on the full throttle on the writing side for a bit, but yeah, I'll get out there. But yeah, it's great to hear you, man. Welcome. Welcome again, and actually worked out that you have one of your fellow authors ended up coming aboard to help Holly out tonight and jump aboard and replace her, because I know we had Holly announced, but we've got a lot pulling us in 50 directions, so RG graciously came aboard, and she is also in Through the Tempest Black with you, and I want to give the floor to you and RG to talk about it, because there's only a few days left in the Indiegogo, and both of you have great stories. I know you have a fantastic story in it, Rob, and talk about the project and why people need to support it, and maybe give a preview of your story, and RG can also talk about that.
Anybody that don't know, if you just Google or DuckDuckGo, however you do it, just Through the Tempest Black in one word, it'll pop up to the indie. It should pop up to the Indiegogo, and of course, this is all the brainchild of the illustrious one, Nathan Day, writer, screenwriter, of course, actor, and of course, editor now. So I mean, he's obviously done a lot with like the Orphan Rise Surfacing and Orphan Desecration through Seven Star, but also. Him and Thomas Moore had a book, The Devil's Alive, through Hydra, which has published the two books in each of my two series as well. But the Through the Tempest Black is going to be great. I mean, you got Michael Nost on there, the Michael Nost. So I know if you go to the webpage, they have different perks that you can get. Like RG's got some books that you can order from there to contribute the money to. And Michael Nost has that, I think it's that Milford style horror writing class, and so people
class,
can get
gem.
Him. Yeah.
That's a
and,
gem.
Michael David Anderson, who I remember a couple years ago, we were on a horror panel. I think it was a horror panel when everything was remote. But he's one of the contributing authors, and of course, J.H. Kimbrell, she's in, you talk about amazing artwork. She posts a lot of art stuff that she
does. Phenomenal,
yeah. Yeah,
she has a poster as one of the perks, I believe.
She has the poster, and she also has her, I want to say it's either three or four books. Like in my case, if you go on there, you'll see like Nathan has the books that I mentioned offered as a perk. Now, I actually have one question, because I wanted to get there's a $50 limited edition that includes a novella called Pilgrimage by Nathan as well. But I think is the Indiegogo site, is that all credit card, or I mean, do they don't accept PayPal or do they?
I don't know. I've looked at the page. I'm gonna, probably at the very last minute, I'm gonna get one of the perks.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know if it does PayPal or not. I would say that it probably does, because it's a big outfit.
Right.
But I can't swear to it.
Yeah, I honestly don't know the answer to that. Yeah, because I've I'm pretty much the Indiegogo projects. I've always just used a credit card or something. But I would bet they do. I would bet they do.
Well,
PayPal offers, like, you can get a PayPal credit card and just pay off of. Use it for stuff like that.
Right.
That is true.
I want to
get
on to some of the authors on there. Now, a couple of the folks I know that, obviously have the books published, RG, Julie, Michael David, and, of course, Michael Nost, Nathan, and myself. But there's some others on there that are, just on the group list I've got, Billy Boyd, Casey Miracle, Cody Witt, Drew Graber. excuse me, Jared Humes, Michael Powers, Pamela Lynn, Schaefer Tolliver, and Tom Farmer. So, and, you know, it's all Lovecraftian and Poe-inspired short stories from a lot of us. You know, Nathan put everything together, did such a great job with everything, with videos, video promos featuring the authors and their works and their influences. He did a he put a ton of work, you know, and great stuff that he added to the cause there to try to, you know, promote it and publicize what was happening. So that's cool. It's great to be a part of something like that, and you know, I'm proud to be a published Seven Star Press author then too at that point when that happened.
That's awesome. Yeah. And speaking of which, I mentioned Lee E.E. Stone earlier, and he just checked into the chat room, and he just missed me talking about Dark Splinters. But, yes, Lee, I did get that in.
All right. Lee with five E's. There you go. Yeah, he got Dark Splinters in. And
Lee
said,
with five E's.
He even said Lee with five E's got a story in it. So you're good. He got you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's a gem of a story. It is fantastic. So, but yeah, welcome, Lee. Yeah. Good to see you joining us tonight. Yeah. We got a crowd in the chat room tonight. It is awesome. So
I wanted to say too, I heard RG, you know, she asked me a question earlier on Facebook. And I went golfing today, and then I was listening to audio of Contract with the Lycanthrope. I heard in the beginning, you know, RG talking about having the ACX narrator for the book she's got now, and this will be the third book this year that the narrator Lily Sage Audio, and she does a great job. And she sent me, I'm almost done, you know, listening to it, and she has done such amazing work with such really difficult material. I don't know how many people have read Contract with the Lycanthrope, but there's several different voices, and they're coming from all kinds of different dimensions, and there's, you know, a lot of weird things that are happening, and she handles all these voices, you know, the men and women character both, and in such a way that it's like, you know, so engaging and so clear and distinct in terms of, you know, who's saying what, when, and where, and just, you know, delivers this just flawless performance, word for word, of course, you know, editing and everything that takes place, but, you know, she's extraordinary, because she also did the first two books of the Rapture series, Cosmic Egg Rapture and Serpent Egg Rapture. The first book there came out in May on Audible and Apple Books, and the second one come out in August. So this one should be out pretty soon. You know, I was in contact with Tony from Acree from Hydra Publications about, you know, wrapping this one up. So I've got one more book, that the Imagine Award winner that came out in 2021, the second book in the Lycanthrope series, Crackers for the Lycanthrope. But, and I've talked with Lily about that, but it's a male, you know, narrator, and it's written like a journal. You know, somebody's like in their late 20s, so I might have to find someone that wants, you know, that can do that voice. But I'm glad to get, you know, I had four books published between 2018 and, you know, last year with Hydra. And I'm still working on the third book in the series, the Rapture series, so trying to capture as much zeitgeist I can, because I know RG mentioned, or maybe it was Daniel mentioned something about the politic backdrop kind of that's in, you know, the Hellscape series. And this Rapture one ties into just kind of updates or real times, kind of the fan being hit by, you know, more than just cosmic debris this time, like the real great red dragon. You know, that, you know, that reminds me, is it Ren Alien, the sponsor, the artist, and author?
Oh, Renmelian. Renmelian.
Renmelian.
Like, sounds like rhymes with chameleon. Renmelian, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think I was connected with her on Twitter on something, and there was a conversation going, and then at some point I think I put up like the Ghost of the Flea by the painting by, you know, William Blake, who, you know, did the Red Dragon, the whole, those paintings that were featured in Red Dragon and the, you know, Hannibal Lecter series by Thomas Harris. But yeah, I never heard anything back after I tweeted a picture of the Ghost of the Flea by William Blake. That's kind of a strange painting.
You scared her off.
Well, you're up. But,
I don't know.
You're up on your art. You always are posting Dolly and all kinds of good stuff. So you're always keeping us up on art. So.
Well, Dolly, yeah. You know, I've said this before. I'm, you know, Dolly is the one that actually wrote the Cosmic Egg Rapture. I'm just the, you know, the credited collaborator, you know. So he's the real ghostwriter in that. So, and the Dolly artwork and ideas, you know, they factor prominently into the reading experience of the book, as does his, you know, some of the physical art that he did as well, the performance art.
A true ghostwriter.
Well, yeah, that's a true ghostwriter. But you've been less reclusive than me, Mr. Hoff, and I know I've seen you bouncing all over the place doing live stuff. So how has the scene been out there? Turnouts going well? Are people feeling pretty comfortable coming back out again? How have these events been going for you?
I hit pause as well, really, this year. I mean, a couple Comic-Cons came up late, and there were things I would normally do in the past, and I didn't do those because I kind of waiting to see on, you know, just having more Lycanthrope stock available. I mean, it's probably going to be a while. I'm kind of in the mode to, you know, pursue all in again when the next book comes out. And I don't really want it to come out this year anyway. So, you know, I didn't go to the Cincinnati show, the Comic and Toy show, the Lexington one. There's a Scare Fest going on, and those were ones that I, you know, would have normally probably have done. But, you know, I've kept it limited and, you know, some smaller venues, you know, Bookstore in Madison, Art Center over in VV, and then, you know, just as I travel along, you know, I'll say I'm going to be somewhere, and, you know, if anybody shows up, I got books with me. That they can find me, because a lot of that involves fishing. Which reminds me, RG, you asked me about did I have any questions about, or you might have questions about ocean fish. I don't know if you checked your Facebook, but right before I come down to get ready for all this, I put in there, well, I just had Black and Grouper special tonight at Jules Restaurant in Warsaw, so I can tell you, you know, from an ocean fish perspective, that was really good, you know.
Delicious.
So. Yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is because the next book in my series is going to take place predominantly in the ocean. So I'm going to have some characters that, you know, if they want to eat, they're going to know how to fish. So.
Well, some of it would depend on where they are. I know, like, one of the ocean fish that factors, I mean, it's, you know, it's almost electric how it functions in Cosmic Egg Rapture, and that's the American Virginia eel from the Sargasso Sea. You know,
they're going to be off the East Coast.
They're going to be off the East Coast. Well, it depends on, you know, how far out and whether you're talking about, like, you know, billfish or, and I remember I once went out to Nantucket and I went to a dock and there was
the
a billfish tournament going on, and nobody had caught any billfish, but one boat had come in with a bluefin, and there was a guy from the because, you know, they were fishing for marlin, and a guy had come in from the state, you know, fishing wildlife, and they were going to keep the tuna, but he cut the, you know, part of the stomach, and he just said, anybody want sushi? So we got some soy sauce and started eating that. I mean, if they got any soy sauce on them, they might, you know, flavor up whatever they do catch, you know.
Yeah.
I'd rather have, like, Old Bay seasoning. Don't get me wrong. Right. I just put some of that on some salmon patties. It was like, you know, good. I eat fish, and it was a real good deal. It was like four of them, you know, for $1.50, you know, all pre-made and frozen. And I put Old Bay on that, but, you know, they're probably not going to be catching anything like it. It depends on how high up they are and how close to shore, like rockfish.
Right.
Somebody else on Twitter I was talking about, I went to Block Island one time off of Rhode Island, and I was staying at a place, and the guy that was like the caretaker, he was like a jazz musician, a guitarist that would play in Boston at like a, mm-hmm. it was a Hyatt or a Holiday Inn or something, but then he'd stay on the Block Island on week when he could, when he wasn't, you know, doing his thing in Boston. But he was like a spear fisherman for rockfish, which are striped bass.
Wow.
So depending on where you are on the coast, and the striped bass, they'll go down as far as, you know, down into the same Virginia area where
right.
the Virginia eel are, because they, both of them actually, like, they spawn up in the brackish mm-hmm. water. That's like the elvers, which are eel fry, eel hatch. There was, like, I lived in this
yeah.
area in Virginia for like 10 years, and they were a big market on for the for Japanese, you know, delicacy
yeah.
by these elvers, because they like to eat them live. So mm. there was a lot of poaching and stuff that went on with that. But one of my dearest friends, and he sadly, he passed away in 2016, but his name was Bill McCloskey, and he was an old, you know, a guy come out of the Coast Guard, you know, right when the Japanese were getting, returning to international water rights after, like, World War II. Mm-hmm. So you had all the Alaska fishermen and all this big tension going on between the two groups and everything. And he wrote a book called, or a series of books called The Highliners, about these handheld, or these line fishermen that, you know, fish those waters. And you know, that's a whole other thing. He did, like, nonfiction stuff, too, where it would deal with, like, fish in the North Atlantic, or, like, the inventor of the pulley block to deal with nets that could catch, you know, tons of herring at a time off the coast of, mm-hmm. you know, Chile, stuff like that. So, you know, there's a lot of resources out there, because that is one of the cool things about doing any kind of location research or historical mm-hmm. research. You know, you can find out and put in real time, you know, and make it as realistic
yeah.
as possible. If somebody's out stranded, you know, if they're floating on the Sargasso Sea, they might just reach
yeah.
down, pluck out an eel, and, like, bite off its head. You never know.
Right.
It just depends how long they've been there.
There was a movie I saw with, I forget what it was called. It had Shailene Woodley in it, and it was based on a true person that got stranded. This woman got stranded out. She was out sailing with her fiance, and they got stranded. And so it was whole survival, and I love survival stuff, you know. So, and one of the things she did was she had this spear, and it had, like, a bungee cord on it. And so she would go swim under, you know, outside the boat, obviously. And she would pull tension on the bungee cord and, like, spear the fish that way. Like,
yeah.
it was almost like a bow and arrow, but it was like she pulled it against her elbow, and it was more like straight out. You know, it wasn't like a bow and arrow at all, actually. But so
that's what Hoff does with the big catfish down at Markland Dam. Yeah,
I don't have nothing to do with them giant catfish.
Yeah,
because they too big. They you know, I mean, I've got some gear that'll handle them, but, you know, it's like. My preferences go more for, like, the kind of game, like a channel catfish, I'll, you know, come up, but that's a significantly, you know, small. I had a River Times article, because I do that fishing column for them, and one
yep.
of the things I put in there for October was the state record. I think it was 109-pound blue catfish that was caught.
Have you ever been noodling,
2 years ago. Huh?
Have you ever been noodling?
Not on purpose. No, that's beyond me, because I have a lot of respect for the snapping turtle. I'm not going to stick
yeah.
my fingers anywhere where that might be cohabitated by a catfish, and you know, I figure if that catfish is all run up in there that much, and that's where he wants to be, then I'm probably just going to leave him alone, because. You know, unless you're doing, like, tournament-wise, because I don't really like to eat the catfish that I catch. I mean, I love catfish. You like farm-raised catfish
yeah.
is delicious. It's like freshwater cod. But now I will keep, from time to time, I will keep catfish that I catch, but I don't use, like, live bait. I use lures. And, you know, I've caught blue catfish on crankbaits, and I've had them bust my line and be like, oh, damn, you know, because they were big. But, you know, the channel cat, like, I'll keep if they're, like, under – you know, between like 15 and 20 inches. And if they start getting bigger now, it gets a little chewy, if you ask me, and hard to get the game out of the meat. But
so you basically use your hand and arm as live bait?
No, not like I say, not intentionally.
So basically, RG, he's making a good case to join your post-apocalyptic team with his expertise in fishing.
Absolutely.
Well,
yeah,
I do rely a lot on the Commonwealth of Kentucky to stock a lot of the fish I catch for. I mean, I do fish for some native species, but Kentucky loads up their waters like no other state. And, I mean, I have to write a little bit about Indiana, too, which I do, but it's like the state stocking, it's really concentrated more up in the north. Like in the Ohio River, of all the states that are contiguous to the Ohio River, Kentucky is like the only one that stocks it with these creations that are part white, freshwater white bass and part saltwater striped bass, the kind of stock you would see like if you went to Lake Cumberland or Harrington Lake, one of the lakes where they actually stock these purebred striped bass. They used to put those things in the river. In fact, I was at my granddad's a couple weeks ago. We used to fish all the time out of a boat. And back when I was writing for a paper in Maysville, I was actually talking to like a marine biologist because they had just stopped stocking the river with the true striped bass. My granddad had caught one that year that was 34 inches and 23 pounds.
Wow.
And, you know, that was one of the bigger ones for out of the river. I mean, you go down to Cumberland and stuff like that, they, you know, you're talking 40, 50 pound they can get. But and on the, when you talk about fishing on the coast, the true striped bass, which they out there they call from the mid-Atlantic up, they call rockfish, those things can get over 100 pounds. And they're big sport up, you know, Montauk Bay and all that up in New York and up that way because they migrate up and down the East Coast and duck out at the middle coast there and, you know, the Virginia Tidewater area.
Well, Rob, when are you going to write a novel that's kind of focused on the water or maybe even like a horror story about something?
I've been reluctant to do that. And to go back to my buddy Bill McCloskey, I was working with him on a couple things to try to, you know, get him back because by the time I knew him, he was like 78 years old. And he wanted to update two books. One was about North Atlantic. These were nonfiction books, and it had a lot of cool stuff about, you know, the cod in Norway, the spawn, and then he had another one that was called, I think, you know, Their Father's Decks. It was about Pacific fishing, and there was like these New Zealand handliners that they had to catch these yellowfin, and they had to catch it by hand because it was all based on how much blood was released, and there was this huge Japanese market for these hand caught, and these they had, you know, specialized, you know, cast aluminum containers to immediately put them in. So they were like under the deadline and stuff. But that guy, the novels that he wrote actually ended up for a while they were published by Nick Lyons Press, which was like a, you know, an amazing nature press about outdoors, hunting, fishing, and all that kind of stuff. And they ended up getting sold, and I think they went to Globe Aquat. And then after that, I think Nick Lyons' son, Tony Lyons, actually started a press of his own in New York and picked up like the last novel in that series of that Bill McCloskey had done before he passed away. But, you know, the fishing stuff is always on my mind. And every book I write, I think every book I write has some mention of fishing in it, and like the Cosmic Egg Rapture specifically mentions this River Times newsprint magazine that I write for monthly in it, you know. But yeah, I don't know if I got like the old man in the sea, but my preference would be like, you know, Steinbeck, like the Black Pearl, you know.
Okay.
That would be cool.
Nice.
But,
that would be cool.
You could always do one about the alligator gar that, you know, that's 40 foot long or something terrorizing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that they get, you know, those things, the further you go down, they're not so much of an issue in the Ohio. Mostly what I catch are the long-nosed ones, which are much thinner. But, you know, it's nothing for, you know, them. I've caught them things 36 inches. They're kind of a pain in the ass because – if you're using a lure, man, then you got to deal with that mouth. And I know a lot of people, because they got teeth on it. You know, it's a big snout that sticks out about a foot and a half with a bunch of teeth that'll lay you open. And them things, man, they just slap the hell out of everything. So, but those big alligator gars, and a lot of people bowfish for them things, and they get 200 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
The further you go down to Mississippi, man, them things aren't playing. They're the size, and they have the set of teeth on them. People have to really wonder, like, when they're, you know, attacks and stuff. I don't know how many get reported. It's probably still more bull sharks coming up, you know, the Mississippi that's got more to do with anything that happens down that way than alligator gar. Alligator snapper, man, that's even worse than a regular one, because you can't grab them by the shell. They have the ability on their necks. They can come back and bite you. And by bite, I mean, like, you know, cut through your finger. So, I mean, they get bigger, but, you know, I try not to fool much with the snapping turtles anymore, but they're really good to eat. You know, just put them in a 55-gallon drum, you know, for a couple days, and then, you know, start cracking at them. They got all different kinds of meat. I like the neck meat the best.
See, folks, you are getting a lot of insight that you never thought you'd get. So you're getting some easy author research tonight. Rob's giving you some insight.
I'm taking notes for sure.
Well, I mean, if you're writing a book with fish in it, you know, it's
yeah.
I mean,
well, they
got to
eat something. I mean, they're going to be on the ocean, so. And
if they're just on the ocean drifting, you gotta have like some blue water stuff. So you might, you know, I don't know how magical things can get, but you know, you could stumble across a farm of AI, you know, nanobot created fish, you know, secret fish farm. You know,
infected
nowadays, that's like one I'm reading right now is Arlen Andrews' Silicon Blood, and it's got all that biotechnology in it in terms of how, you know, the self-assembling molecules and how they can target, you know, and his big thing in this is these enmophages, which internally eat, you know, people from the inside if they're designed to do that. Of course, they can be vectors and carry disease and all kinds of plagues and cause all kinds of pandemics and other things too. But it's a pretty interesting book. You know, there's a lot of
is it out?
Yeah, it's been out. And when I first met Arlen in 2018, I actually got his Valley of the Shaman book first and was reading that and loved that. I put a review up on my website, and I didn't see. I met Arlen, I got this book, and I kind of got it, and I didn't go into it as much because, you know, he's a hard nuts-and-bolts science fiction writer. He's been on, you know, Ancient Aliens a couple times, but he's usually engineering voice trying to technically explain how people did it and what kind of actual instrumentation they did it with. You know, he's in friends with the guy that did that Giza power plant book that, you know, kind of gave this other theory on that, but... I didn't read this, and I went through it, and I'm thinking, man, because you're starting to hear a lot about nanobot technology now. You're starting to hear a lot about, you know, science fiction things that seem to be coming to life. And he wrote in here, for Rob Hoff, hope you enjoy our dark future. Arlen Andrews, March of 2018.
That sounds like him.
That sounds
exactly like
Arlen,
him.
Man. Yeah.
Yep.
But
yeah, he had a really good book that I can't forget the title. I remember the title, but it was about voyages from China to North America, back.
Yeah. No, he was the editor. It's called Chasing Dragons. He was the editor.
That's
that was something.
The editor.
Hydra had
that
an imprint called Talisman Press.
Yeah.
And I think the
yeah, that's what I'm familiar with.
Yeah, they wrote, that's about the Chinese coming into Middle America, the Cahokian Empire in the 15th century, and there's kind of some, you know, collateral explanation, like what happened to the Cahokians, and it has a lot to do with the Chinese travelers delivering perhaps bubonic plague. I mean, who knows, but they kind of just vanished.
Yeah, that's an interesting book. Yeah, and it was with Arlen somehow.
Well, Arlen's bread and butter has been science fiction stories. He's been published in so many Analog and you know, any all of the big science fiction, you know, magazines from the 70s and 80s and, you know, probably starting in the 70s. But, you know, and I even, he sent me a story because, you know, he kind of wants to dabble, see some of his stuff adapted to screen. And he sent me a short story called Mother Love. And because I talked to him at Imaginarium with, you know, a couple other people might be interested in doing some kind of film stuff. And this is just a real short, like 15-minute thing. And, you know, he was talking about, like, you know, submit it to Imaginarium and, you know, dust the streaming or the not. They don't stream, but they archive what they release. You know what I'm talking about? The dust channel on you know, the Internet. They got, you know, a lot of cool stuff there. So I went ahead and wrote a screenplay up for him, and he, you know, he seemed to like it. I haven't heard anything back really yet as far as if there's going to be anything else going on for it. But Hydra's got their finger. Tony's got that finger in the, you know, the movie scene. So I'm sure he's going to have some stuff break that's, you know, over the wall,
yeah,
man, because, you know, he always does.
He's been working at it.
All the film stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's been working at it, and yeah, definitely have to have him on early in the new year just to give updates because he's so darn busy working on
it. I saw some kind of post. I probably shouldn't say that. I don't know if it was like Hyder Authors or what it was, but anyway, you know, a lot of those authors there got great stuff that could be, you know, adapted. I mean, they could make, you know, Arlen Andrews, between his short stories and his novels, I mean, they could make, you know, 10 different shows and, you know, 20 episodes in each one if they wanted. I mean, you could do him like a Twilight Zone thing where every one of them is different because he's got so many different stories. He's probably got hundreds of them published.
Yep.
But I thought I'd just try it out. I'm not really looking to screenwriter, although I did tell you, like, if you guys ever start back up, what is it, the ISEA in Lexington at the Joseph Best?
We're just waiting for approval to do it again because they kind of shut them down because of the whole pandemic thing. But we're, you know, just kind of put everybody on hiatus. But I think that they will let us do one pretty soon. So I'm hoping, it's within the next very few months that we'll be able to do one again.
Well, I might actually sit in when you guys start up on something like that because I hadn't done anything like that before. So I just looked online and tried to see a format. You know, and a couple people, I think, checked it out, and then they can figure out what they're going to do with it, if anything. But it was kind of fun to, you know, apply the story to that format. But I don't really see myself doing that, you know, at any kind of scale, because I'd rather just, you know, I'm getting this Rapture 3, and then I'll have a Lycanthrope 3, because that whole series delves into the, you know, not the Chasing Dragon type thing, but the whole legend of Madoc. So...
Yeah,
and the Welsh exploration into, you know, the southern part of the Gulf of Mexico area, whether it's some say 6th century, some say 12th, and then, you know, eventually merging with natives there. I think it's the Euclea was the tribe that was attributed to that. And then, you know, having war with the Cherokee and then ended up like in the Falls of Ohio and on the Ohio River, you know, because there was a book James Alexander Tom wrote called The Children of First Man that's about that. It's a historical novel that tries to track that 12th century arrival up in the Gulf of Mexico, in Alabama, and then up into Tennessee. And then, over the course of 3 centuries, so...
Well, the book also applies well to the Halloween season, too. So, yeah, it's definitely one that we should mention would be a great pickup right now.
If anybody wants to get the howl scared out of them, I would – when contract for the Lycanthrope, because, you know, we all got a lot to do. And everybody's, you know, would like to read more than they do. And I'm – you know, I tend to just post – I don't read as much as I once did, and – but when I do, I'll put a book on a review on my website at robhoffauthor.com. And I'm going to do that as soon as I finish up Silicon Blood because, you know, I started like 3 days ago, and it's all hell breaks loose, man. And it's really got a lot to speak about now in terms of today, what kind of technology really does exist, because, you know, the more you get into that aspect of it, I'm not really the sci-fi guy to go to, but I'll glean stuff off of it as it kind of applies to what I'm doing. But just from like an entertainment standpoint in terms of, you know, is could this really be real? Of course, that's the whole spin with the sci-fi stuff anyway, right? Are they onto something that's going to actually come true? Then it's like even the dystopians like Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, you know, which I try to blend in as much speculative fiction as well with the Rapture series. But Halloween-wise, yeah, if you want to get the howl scared out of you, check out Contract with the Lycanthrope, because, I mean, that's one rip-roaring ride, and it's got the terrifying stuff in it with really supernatural madness just flourishing everywhere. So, and, of course, the Imagine Award winner, Crackers for the Lycanthrope.
Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. But I didn't do it. You know, I did a signing last year with on Halloween in Madison. And I was up there, and I thought about, well, I might do that again and just take what I have up there with me. And because they carry my books in a place called Gifts at Last. Oddly, the bookstore has – every time I go up there, the bookstore is, like, shut down. It's like they don't let people come in.
Oh, yeah.
It's like every time there's some kind of thing, you know, and it's shut down. But this other guy, you know, the Gifts at Last, Alan and Barb Long own that place. They have, like, a New Age section with a lot of – whether it's, you know, psychedelia or, you know, pagan stuff or astronomy or astrology. You know, they got tarot cards and all kinds of crystals and stuff like that. It's a real cool shop. And, you know, I stopped in there, but didn't want to – I really didn't feel the urge this time to do, like, a Halloween thing. I'm really kind of going to glide in, see what shakes in 2022, see how interesting things get off of the pages and how much of that I can really kind of capture and channel in my own, the way I write kind of hyper-sigilistic, you know, fiction, which goes kind of one step further than where a trope might leave off.
Well, yes. Yes, Rob, you are unique. What's that, RG?
I said, I've never heard the phrase sigilistic fiction. That's really interesting.
Well, I call it magic with a K, surrealism. But
right.
It's like, yeah, it's just, you know, where you have, because it delves more into, really those books become more occult fiction. And at this point, both series are really occult horror.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Cosmic Egg Rapture one really started out as less occult and more tied into, you know, Atlantis and, you know, the nature of kind of reality based on Egyptian mythology and Salvador Dali art techniques and theories and the kinds of portals that could open up, you know.
Okay.
But it's really headed into the occult horror realm. But I liken it to magic realism, only it's magic with a K, surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah,
it's cross-genre. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're not easily categorized, Mr. Hoff. It's definitely you bring a lot of different genres to the table in your work. But cross-genre is a very hot topic these days in the literary circles, so that's a good thing.
Well, I've tried to just stay and write what it is I want to write, because I wrote for a living. But it was all nonfiction. It was newspaper. It was magazine stuff. It was nonfiction book stuff. And, you know, when I first started, I got into journalism because I did write a novel and self-published it like in the mid-90s. And that actually got me into journalism. I stopped writing fiction just because I had to write so much real stuff all the time. You know, it was like, oh. But, so when it's something that hits me, I mean, I studied English literature in college and got a degree, but I didn't go any further than that in terms of masters or doctorates or any of that kind of thing. But I was definitely steeped in, you know, literary critical theory. And the influence of art on novels, like to go back to like William Blake and, you know, other artistic adaptations, like even something like the Da Vinci Code, you know, that would be translated today, and or Foucault's Pendulum, but really Da Vinci Code, because there's so much artwork in that that factors prominently, not just the Mona Lisa, the Virgin of the Rocks, but just kind of the symbolism and theories of other, you know, forms of,
well,
you
know, I, really
I don't
like
want to say, I don't even say religion,
yeah.
But.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's all right. That's all I was going to say on that one.
Yeah. No, I mean, the other books in the series, I know Da Vinci Code gets a lot of buzz, but
yeah.
the other Robert Langdon books are just as compelling, I think, you know, like with the symbolism, because he's really playing with, you know, the symbolism of what,
yeah.
what
well,
the possibilities are.
Well, especially when
are.
It relates directly to a literary or like an artistic tradition, because
yeah.
if you take Inferno, I mean that's even more so
mm-hmm.
with Dante
yeah.
and the death mask, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's probably even more today. I mean, the Da Vinci Code spawned all these kind of cottage things that
yeah.
you know came about in terms of cracking the Da Vinci Code. What does this mean? Because they're saying this is
mm-hmm.
a complete reinterpretation of something that was, you know, for all these centuries perceived to be this thing, like when you're looking at
mm-hmm.
the Last Supper, and now it's being explained in a different way, and it has all this
yeah.
esoteric philosophy baked in it, plus actual history that could be
yeah.
actual and not just, you know, problematic in how it's presented in a narrative form.
Mm-hmm.
But like with Inferno, that's even cooler, because what's it all about? It's about a plague that's going to kill everybody on the planet.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
This plague wasn't designed to do that, but the one we got, but it's still, it's like timely to see
right.
that
yeah.
there's, you know, and he tied it all back to Dante. Cause so to me,
yeah.
that's like something I pick up that I'm doing, you know, that
mm-hmm.
I put in what I'm working on right now. So
yeah.
it folds back into really a lot of tarot card stuff and
mm-hmm.
different types, because Salvador Dali designed a deck, you know, and it starts jumping into Aleister Crowley. And it does also a rather obscure writer named John Uri Lloyd, who was like a pharmacologist in Cincinnati at the turn of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And he wrote like a Hollow Earth novel that an illustrator did these, you know, amazing illustrations on about, you know, giant mushrooms under the earth in this advanced civilization that had, you know, so it's kind of like all the stuff you see basically now, like on Ancient Aliens related to Antarctica.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Well, tell us a little bit about what your submission for Through the Tempest Black. I'm excited to read your story.
Open up too much. I wanted to make sure that I incorporated a Lovecraftian principle, which
mm-hmm.
I did. And like an Edgar Allan Poe manifestation with a twist, which I did. And the story itself is just brutal. It's hellish. It's the total, you know, void that Lovecraft, in terms of how big and vast and how hopeless and helpless the individual seems in this, you know, larger than the mind can wrap around realm. So it fleshes that thing out, and it does it in a way that I listen to a lot of the Stooges Funhouse album for that, like over and over again. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did think of you, Rob. Speaking of music, I was writing to Fields of the Nephilim a lot recently, and I was like,
Hoff
would like this.
Some of that stuff, you know, I'm like, you know, with different musicians and bands, but that whole Morning Sun album, I've done a lot of writing
yeah.
and editing on that.
It's fantastic.
It's, you know, it suits that kind of, you know,
yep.
mentality, mindset you have to have when you sit down to do you know, certain things. And I mean, agreed. I listen to music. Music factors in it more probably than, you know, anything else in this process, because, you know, I'll go on and it's, you know, it can be, there was a French band that did one album in 1971 called Ophiuchus after the constellation, which is actually a zodiac constellation, but it's the 13th zodiac constellation, but it's never credited for it because it messes up the whole 12 system. But, you know, it was weird because they have, on Ophiuchus, there's two stars in that system that are binary stars, and I think one's a dwarf star, one's a giant star. I think it's one's white and one's blue. I can't remember exactly the details, but the one, it releases into the atmosphere of the other this accretion that over time builds up, and it erupts in a thermonuclear explosion. And they've noticed that it's in the same constellation, Ophiuchus, where like Kepler, when he charted the supernova that happened in like 1604, and it just blew up in the night sky, man. And, you know, all them people were looking up thinking, wow, look at that. You know, what is that? What had just happened? But this one, these two stars, it blows up like every 15 years. And but this time it did it in August. I want to say like August 12th or something like that, and all of a sudden these people are writing it. It's like, hey, that star just went from, you know, this magnitude to a more visible magnitude, like three times of what it was before, and that's what it was. But, you know, that Ophiuchus album is very cool. It's very ambient. And another Tangerine Dream. I like Zeit a lot. I listen to that a lot. Popol Vuh. They got an album called Affenstund. Those things are just conducive to opening up the pathways to, you know, visualize what you want to do with the work and then actually execute, you know, the writing of it while it's going on. And then there's other stuff like Cosmic Egg Rapture was almost entirely written listening to Joy Division stuff over and over again.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I don't think I knew that yet. That's awesome.
Yeah,
but I knew you were
person. I mean, you guys, I know you got a lot of musical influences. What, you know, like to do Hellscapes, what does the Zim crank up to infiltrate his mind with while he's knocking it out? Or do you listen to music when you write?
Oh, I always listen to music when I write, and it's actually it serves a function. It kind of creates a bubble. I actually get more distracted from neighborhood noise or cars outside or people than I do. Like music actually seals all that off for me so I can keep in my zone. And I do use it for moods, yeah, certainly. And, when I get into Hellscapes, it gets a little bit more into the heavier end of the heavy metal spectrum. I mean, I listen to, you know, stuff like Slayer and things like that to just get the vibe, you know, just the real mean, ominous kind of vibe. I mean, sometimes, you know, other things, you know, like Creator or, you know, Cataclysm or groups like that. But typically really heavy, dark-edged kind of real heavy stuff to kind of give that tone that I'm kind of going for there. I mean, it's not that's why I said it's not for the faint of heart.
a lot of that gets problematic too. I mean, I don't know, Daniel, do you listen to music when you do the Ripper stuff or what?
I listen to show tunes.
Show tunes? Wow, man.
I listen
to
Sweeney Todd, Phantom of the Opera, different things like that while I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And I see when I put on the Phantom of the Opera hat, unfortunately or fortunately in my case, I'm not sure, but it has to be like, you know, the meteors from Curse of the Mutants, you know, a Phantom of the Opera. He rules this evil place.
I listen to the techno version when it's in my various playlists. The late '90s techno version of the Phantom of the Opera.
Oh wow!
I always like the Nightwish song, Phantom of the Opera. That's a gem. The band Nightwish, if you're familiar, symphonic metal band out of I believe Finland. Yeah, they are.
Well, now, Notre Dame, I got to add this in, too, because one of the things is, like, you know, like RG's talking about, you know, the ocean. But anywhere anybody's got a setting, I mean, and that's what's cool about really short stories, too. The setting becomes even more magnified because you've got this real limited amount of time and space to deliver the goods. You know, you can't expand it out and really, you know, delve into other areas. But like the Notre Dame Cathedral, like with the Hunchback of Notre Dame, you know, he's it's kind of that whole Phantom of the Opera feel too. So I mean, there, you know, that the horror stuff. I mean, it's interesting to see how that all comes together in people's minds. I told Shrewsbury that I was going to mention the book he's got with the Killer of Giants with Seven Star, and I think him and Brian King, I believe they're doing something with Jason Sizemore.
Yeah, Apex.
Apex. It's like
they've got several. They won Imagine Award with one of those, and the title just escapes my brain right now because
They did one called King of the Bastards.
I believe that's the one that won.
I think this is like part of that
Imagine
series. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They got a new one now.
Well, he's a good dude, man. I just throw him a shout out, you know, because he got a lot of books out, and I know he's done several with you. You know.
Yeah, Brian actually wrote a foreword for the new Killer of Giants release, so Brian did contribute to this. Yeah, so really grateful for that and appreciate it very much.
Rob, you
great.
Had a shout-out from the chat room. Matt
Smith.
Wait
a minute. I got in there, but I haven't been looking.
Yeah,
oh, Carol?
Matt Smith,
Carol?
Appalachian Ghost. He says hello.
Who does?
The ghost with the most.
Oh. Wait a minute, I'm way up here.
The Appalachian Ghost. That's right.
Oh,
the ghost at the most.
Oh, that's my boy Matthew right there, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
Matt. We're gonna be working on some posts for Nobody's Listening this coming up weekend. So a little tiny scoop there.
Yeah, Matt actually.
Hold on a minute. What did I hear? You're working up some posts?
Yeah, no, I'm doing post-production for a movie that was filmed in May.
Oh,
Amy McCorkle wrote it. Amy and Missy wrote it.
Oh, okay. All right, cool.
I produced it. Eric Sheldahl directed it, and Matt Smith was heavily involved in all of the above.
Yeah, he was a blast at Imaginarium, you know. He had the camera running everywhere.
Yeah,
so he got everything he needed to see and, you know, do some stuff with, you know, I know John Pike had the Hot Wheels. He was running down the rails of the steps in the hotel and stuff and, you know, a lot of other things going on there. Yeah, he's
story with him on Imaginarium was awesome. I mean, he is the only person I've ever seen that walked into an awards ceremony, literally walked in the door to the ballroom as his name was being called out. So he literally didn't even stop. He walked in to the ballroom.
Well, you know,
his name was announced, he just walked straight up to the stage and got his award.
Well,
it was the funniest thing I've ever seen.
He was with a group of people, man. You know, it wasn't like he was staying outside kind of trying to anticipate like a snap count when he was going to jump the line of scrimmage, you know.
He's coming
with Nathan
in
and a bunch of other people, man. He literally just walked right by me and, you know, and went right up to the stage, man. No, you know, no wait,
skip
no
a beat.
Delay.
I mean, walked in with the group. He even had, like, food with him. And he heard his name and went straight up to the stage and won an award for his music video. So, that was hilarious. I have never seen that happen.
Yeah, he's got a lot going on. He's, you know, he's really talented on the stuff that he does, and I'm sure he's going to be up to some big things and, you know, doing what he loves to do. So that's cool. And I think, you know, a lot of people involved in all that, they appreciate what he does, and that's you know, power to him and the projects that he gets involved with, you know.
Yeah.
But now the idea of RG and
of the project.
But I'm still laughing about that Rob put in my head the image of RG and Matthew out putting posts up in a field like somewhere. I'm still chuckling about that.
Some of our projects are that weird.
You were
saying about Matthew,
thing.
RG?
That we could. Well, let's see. Where was I? I was saying about three different things.
Stop being so tripolar, RG, will you? You're making me dizzy over here.
Now, the reason he was filming so much that weekend is we were going to make a parody video of Snoop Dogg's Holiday Inn. And, like, I had rewritten the lyrics. I'd done, like, half the song. And, you know, we were, like, trying to find a performer. And, like, it was going to be this whole big thing. But we were so, like, you know, I mean, convention brain. You get sucked into everything that's happening. And so, but I don't know what kind of footage he has. I'm curious to see if we could, like, patch it together and see what we could do.
Oh, I'm sure you could raise all kinds of hell with that. Or post.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we'll put up some posts.
Yeah, this is going to be good. I'll get some video if I can. I'll try.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the thing, too. You know, when he can shoot the way he can shoot, and I think, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing his projects and how they progress and how, you know, his own distinct kind of, you know, contribution to scene and, you know, whether it's, you know, chiaroscuro or whether it's, you know, just how he does stuff, because I think he's got a definite talent, you know, there to capture on film like a filmmaker and should that enhances whatever the material is.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But
he's the go ahead, Rob.
Oh, no, you go ahead. I was wondering, how are we doing on time? 10, 11? Okay.
We got about 19, 18 minutes, which is an eternity in broadcasting, as you know. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, at least you know there ain't no damn dead air with me, boy.
No.
Okay, we'll go.
I was mentioning that before the show to RG and Daniel. So, like, once Rob gets going, we don't have to worry. We can definitely get a good show.
It's curious. I'm glad you said what you did about, you know, Seven Star, the three, your Hellscapes and Steve Shrewsbury's book and the Lee Stone.
That Dark Splinters
and the Michael Moss, Dark Splinters,
mm-hmm.
and obviously the
– And Brick,
you know,
Marlin's
Azarian. And Brick Marlin. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's good to see a lot of this stuff happening. And, you know, I love the print form. But really this year from May, you know, I mean, I had the one Audible book that Lily Sage had completed in May by the time, you know, Imaginarium rolled around. But I just, you know, I don't have anything to do with that production, but I do listen to them before they come out. And she's just an amazing talent. I don't know if she's listening or not, but – Lily Sage, you know, exactly what RG said at the beginning. It's like, I have found my narrator. And that, she's done three of these, and I think she's just very, very talented. Her voice does what she needs to do to match, you know, what's written and how to just do all the things that make it necessary to differentiate and imagine what the scenes are and what the characters are doing and what's going on inside of them to, you know, be conveyed out by that voice. And this contract with the Lycanthrope she did is, it would be even more difficult than a normal audio book, because there's voices, there's disembodied voices in this, and there's this whole mishmash of, you know, who can hear it and who can't. So there's all kinds of different, more challenging, you know, scenes and characters, I think, than it would be for, like, say, just a normal type of audio narration where you're just doing, you know, the straightforward dialogue without all this other kind of layered dimension stuff happening. But she did.
So
I'll be done soon, but by tomorrow. And she just floored me with it, because she asked me even, you know, she Twittered messaged me and was like, you know, who are some of the characters, you know, to way I could differentiate, you know, the voices in this. And I said, well, the three main that start out, go, you know, look at the Outsiders and, you know, take a look at the Matt Dillon character, the Thomas C. Howe character. I told her one other one. and just I said, and I matched them to like the characters in the book, and said it's kind of like this is kind of the vibe each one of these has in terms of where they're, you know, how they connect to each other in the way that they do. Of course, there's a lot more. There's Supreme Court, you know, corruption. There's, you know, judicial abuse and, you know, global trafficking of all kinds involved in this book. But, you know, so it's not quite like The Outsiders, obviously. But the other one, there's an older woman character, a Grammy, and I said, go look, listen to the Granny on Beverly Hillbillies. I said, that's not what we're looking for, but it's like that type of dialect, because the dialect gets spelled out with a couple of the characters in the book, because it typically takes place in kind of, doesn't really say where, but Tennessee, Kentucky, on a kind of curve there. So, but yeah, once you get to get a really good narrator like that, and I just love the fact she loves reading what I write and, you know, narrating it with her talent. Mm-hmm. And I feel really, you know, privileged to have stumbled across. I found, you know, we came across each other on Twitter. I was somebody's post, and next thing I know, I'm talking to her, and, you know, because I had thought about the audio, but I was so busy writing the books, I just laid the Audible stuff on the back burner. And then Tony was like, Acri at Hydra was like, hey, we're starting to do more, you know, Audible books. This is how it works. You know, there's an ACX system. These people read, mm-hmm. and then if they pick, they can pick a book when it's posted, and if they like it, they'll audition. They send like a 15-minute clip. And that's how we, you know, came across each other. And I mean, she does a lot of other books too, but I feel like, you know, it's rewarding, you know, when you got somebody that's does the narration and they're like, can I read your next book? You know, it's like, yeah. You know, and then it's like each time it's been even better each time. So it's like she just really, you know, seems to flourish. And I mean, this isn't easy stuff to read. There's a lot of horror in it. There's a lot of body horror. You know, there's some foul language. There's all kinds of brutal actions and commentaries. And, you know, it's a whole different kind of culture, really, in terms of how this kind of, you know, underlying conspiracy that, you know, is in charge of the larger institutions, this kind of deep state apparatus, and how it's kind of manipulated at this Supreme Court justice nominee process level. So...
very cool. Right up my alley too.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I don't go heavy on like, it's not like it's, don't get me wrong. It's not like this is kind of Tom Clancy or something like that, but it's
Bob,
like,
I love that Byzantine intrigue. That's always good.
But Glenn, I told Glenn Porzig I was going to burn his ears up tonight. Now, I don't know if
he should. We all need to.
Yeah,
some Porzig on the show here.
I think you've been on his show. He used to do the video, the vlog.
Yes, he has been on the show. Yeah,
and,
it was great.
You know,
I love that
split
show.
Screen. Well,
yeah,
he did,
I was on one
contract,
episode.
Oh, man, when Contract with Lycanthrope came out in book form in 2019, I love it. I got it on YouTube, and I got the click, and every once in a while I'll just post it. Because, you know, it's like he said, it's put out this way. It's like, I don't know how many people read Carlos Castaneda, but it's like Carlos Castaneda writes Pulp Fiction is what I describe, you know, Contract with the Lycanthrope. For anybody that has read Carlos Castaneda or seen Pulp Fiction, you know, if you've got one or the other, then you got an idea what's happening. And if you had the two kind of collide, you know, at high projectile speed directly into each other, this is kind of, because there's like a nuclear plant sabotage that's like a political diversion, like a Gulf of Tonkin red herring diversion to try to create this false news narrative that will, you know, A, cause all opposition to this nomination to be removed from like a Senate House subcommittee that's in the process of doing the nomination and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's like the one. It's like, you know, I mean, if you have any of that political kind of backdrop interest and stuff, it's like in a lot of people that read, you know, South American type fiction, the Castaneda's more, you know, Mexican Sonoran desert, dealing with sorcery and, you know, hallucinogenic plants and, you know, astral projection and other
Fun stuff.
You know,
yeah.
mysteries of the mind. But, you know, the South American kind of literature, whether it be like an Alejo Carpentier or, Isabel Allende, I mean, just from a kind
Paulo
of classic
Coelho,
point. There's
Brazil.
Yeah,
don't forget Paulo Coelho in Brazil.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of my,
top
five.
A lot of that's,
yeah.
Yeah, man. You know, that gets into that fabulous realm, too, which to me is an interesting genre, because it's not really magical realism, because this was a cool thing about Imaginarium this year for me is I was on seven panels, you know, and I try to prepare for stuff. One of them, magical realism. In fact, Drew Graver.
Michael Williams.
Orphy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, that was the literary panel. I was on a literary panel with Tommy.
Great, literary.
Smith.
Tommy
yeah.
B. Smith.
Well, Michael was on. Michael Williams was on that, too, though. Yeah, that was a lot of fun, man. I enjoyed doing
yes.
it.
Yeah,
that was one. I wanted
gems.
To see that one, but I think I was occupied. I was either on a panel or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we were on the NaNoWriMo panel together.
Yeah.
RG,
which is about to start.
Yeah.
That's
well,
coming right
it,
up in about 11, 12 days.
I don't know what
yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing yet, because I'm really book is like, you know, I'm like tuned in to things I haven't been tuned in before. So I'm listening to, like, because this book is ostensibly the last book that, you know, if somebody wants to pay me $50,000 in advance to write book four, I'd probably say, okay, I think I can come up with something. But if that's not the case, this is probably where this thing ends. And it evolved. It basically is steeped in Revelation 10, 11, and 12, and this is kind of the fruition of 12. So this, you know, I'm actually seeking different information related to, like, those who might be considered prophets that are, you know, speak about the idea of the rapture as like a, not necessarily a biblical event, but this Christian, you know, eschatological type. Because it's not, Catholics don't believe it, Methodists don't believe in anything like that, but it's all based on the tribulation that's in Revelation, really 11, where it talks about, like, the two witnesses, because that also comes to a head in this, but it really starts to emerge and gets developed, Revelation 11 and the two witnesses who, you know, that are can't be killed and kill in
their
own way.
Yeah, we could do a show on that. Yeah, we could do a
yeah.
show on
well,
that.
You know, you know, this is all...
Oh,
and whether,
yeah.
whether it's
mm-hmm.
like Moses or Elijah or Enoch, and I got my own
Enoch.
Theories and ideas.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. A lot of cool speculation there. But, yeah, it's a fun part of it. Yeah, I imagine you've had a lot of,
well, so,
a lot
I mean,
of fun with
where
that
I'm
topic.
At. And, yeah, and there's a lot of, you go to YouTube and stuff, I mean, and there's like hundreds of thousands of people watching these things, and they're coming out. And, I mean, there's one that he talks about, you know, different things that are in Enoch. He was talking about Salvador Dali's The Fourth Dimension, the painting that Dali did where he's got the Christ on the drawers, where he's coming off, the drawers are like shaped in a cross, and he's like, you know, floating off of it. But the whole rapture thing's got its own kind of delineation based on, you know, Baptist and like Pentecostal. So that rapture is part of that whole series. That concept, you know, and it follows all these different guideposts. And believe it or not, the Virginia American eel that spends half its life in the Sargasso Sea factors into the rapture. But you got to read to figure that one out.
Okay. Now, that's a tagline right there that you got to use that.
And just be glad the poachers didn't get to them elvers first, or otherwise – who knows what wouldn't have happened, right? Am I right?
Right.
<You're> right.
Who knows what wouldn't have happened?
So now we know why Rob is so active as a fisherman, because he's actually helping save the end times stuff. You know,
well,
it,
you know, and
it's real.
Interesting, because I'm you know, again, a lot of this goes back to, say, classical training, whether it was reading John Milton's Paradise Lost or, you know, 17th century English poetry, the likes of, you know, Andrew Marvell or John Donne or George Herbert. I mean, just a bunch of different things that are tied into actual, because the Bible is a brutal book. And It's amazing.
Oh, if
how
you read
much,
the whole thing,
you know,
yes, it is. Yeah, it can. There's a lot
but
of stuff.
And
yeah.
Again, my focus is staying on that end times end game, you know, just for the purposes of this series. And I think I come off, you know, pretty well with how I pieced all this together. And I'm trying to, you know, anytime you're dealing with a real landscape, this is the cool thing about Arlen's Silicon Blood book. It's near future. So it's like takes this one step where it's, okay, now there's a unified South America. There's no individual countries, you know, and the size of the, you know, their commodity, their contraband commodity is $1 billion a day business. So, and it's how nanobiotechnology mm-hmm. ends up introduced to destroy that, and then mm-hmm. the kind of retaliation. So it's got that mm-hmm. bare basic, brutal, organized crime horror, you know, in the kind of the true crime feel to it. But
I'm going to have to read that because I read futurism stuff all the time and a lot of the topics you mentioned. Nonfiction is.
Right. Are you there? Oh, shit.
I'm here.
Am I still on?
Yeah,
you're still on.
Oh.
Loud and clear.
Oh, you didn't hear my expletives, did you?
No.
Okay. Because I'm calling on a landline, so I got two phones, and the battery just went out.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm one of the landline leftovers. So once they jam all them signals and that 5G turns everybody vaccinated into a death. No, I'm just kidding. But I got a landline. Hey, what greater time for more material though? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If you start looking at things, if you start peeling back some of the layers and you're like, well, I might have been born during the day, but it wasn't yesterday kind of thing. You know, just that real common kind of horse sense stuff starts happening. And after time, it's like, you know, wait a minute here. You know,
we'll talk whenever you get to see me and we can have a bourbon together. I will tell you about my process of the latest Rising Dawn Saga novel because it was weird. Surreal is the understatement of writing that given what we're going through now. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I really hope that this kind of publishing format that's been really enabled through, you know, the on-demand printing and people being able to format stuff themselves and send it and have it available on demand, as well as all these other formats, Kindle and, you know, audio and now Vella for novellas and stuff. But I hope it's a big surge again and all the people that were writing, you know, have stuff that's infused with just the angst and the kind of the raw drama of and this the unknowns and what we're kind of seeing more than transformation. In some ways, we're seeing things, you know, really revolutionized, and a lot of it's not for the best. So we'll see how it all fleshes out. But, you know, all that source is there for people to tap into and really kind of, you know, it's like everything got magnified. I mean, there was still, you know, life like it was before, but, you know, people were more concerned about world record egg Instagram posts than they were, am mm-hmm. I going to walk outside, catch something, and die in a week, you know?
Right, yeah.
Or is I'm going to drive somewhere and somebody's burning up the Arby's, you know, you just don't know.
Well, Rob, we're coming up on a couple minutes left in the show, so go ahead and give your contacts for folks to find you so they can stock up on Hoff ebooks.
Yeah, best just go to Amazon, go to Barnes & Noble. It's Rob, R-O-B-B with two Bs, H-O-F-F with two Fs. I have a website, robhoffauthor.com, but I don't have a lot of the inventory right now, and I probably won't for a while until next year. But you can get, you know, Apple Books, you can get the audio books. All those audio books are going to be, the Rapture ones are on there right now. So whatever kind of device you got, as long as they keep sending the signal and Apple stays Apple and, you know, Facebook stays Facebook, I'm on there under Rob Hoff Author mm-hmm. and Red Leg Rob on Twitter. So that's how you kind of figure out what I'm doing.
Fantastic. Well, Rob, you go ahead and you can say a last word, but then RG and Daniel, you two can take us out. And been awesome talking with you tonight, Rob. Always a great talking with Rob Hoff, two Bs, two Fs. I'm always ecstatic when speaking with you. So
I want to see. I want to see that. I want to see that penny farthing of the dark one at the next Imaginarium, if possible. Okay.
Off the roof. Yes.
Off the roof and to the moon. Give me some Dogecoin on my way up, please.
You got it.
It's pumping tonight.
It is pumping tonight, so you never know.
All right. Hey, people, take care. Great talking to you. Love you guys.
Take care, Rob.
Be careful, Rob.
All right.
Go ahead, RG and Daniel. Take us on out.
Okay, you can find me at rgwesterman.com, and I really need to go and update my website. But you can find me on Facebook, RG Westerman, and you can find me on Twitter at RG Westerman and Instagram at RG Westerman. So, had a great time. See y'all next time.
And tonight we gave you a education on fish that you might not have known about, and also, you know, on writing and voice acting work and stuff like that, that you might have a talent for. Have you tried voice acting? If not, record some of your voices and see what you can have come of them. Until we talk to next week, be creative. This is Daniel Dark signing out.